You know how it goes. You're walking around, you're not looking where you're going, and suddenly you bump into the arms of a stranger.
Oh, God. So sorry.
Get your hands off.
I'm really sorry.
For Valentine's Day, I talk with Elizabeth Gilbert, the author of Eat, Pray, Love. She explains how her relationship was saved by the zeal of U.S. immigration policy.
A most unlikely Cupid was Officer Tom of the Department of Homeland Security, who arrested and handcuffed my sweetheart in front of me and took him away at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport.
Plus, before the machines become our overlords, first they have to beat us at Jeopardy.
Shall we play a game?
It was freaky to watch it just, you know, mop up the floor with categories where I would not even have the slightest chance of guessing at something.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and that is all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. And on today's show, we'll use safety scissors to cut out red construction paper hearts for everybody listening, even the people with cooties, and then attach tiny sugar candies that say, "Be mine" on each one. Actually, we're going a little darker this Valentine's Day.
She tells me quietly that if I don't leave her alone, she's going to disembowel me.
But first,
this is a computer. It can do 8 different jobs all at once. 8. Saves a lot of time.
Ever since John Henry faced down the steam-powered hammer, we've been counting down the days before machines finally, totally win. Filmmakers like to envision a future where we're enslaved by our computer overlords, like in The Matrix. But the latest round in this ongoing battle is happening on television.
Watson.
Who is Maurice Chevalier?
Correct.
Same category, 400.
This week, IBM's newest supercomputer, called Watson, goes up against the two all-time Jeopardy champions. The writer Clive Thompson visited Watson last year while it was gearing up for its big match.
It was very interesting because I'd been writing about AI for 10 years or so.
Artificial intelligence.
Artificial intelligence, right, yes. And if you had asked me a year ago, do you think you're going to have a computer that can play Jeopardy, that can understand an English language sentence well enough that it can go out and find the answer to that question? I would absolutely have said no. I would have said, no, you're dreaming. And since I'm not very good at Jeopardy at all, it was freaky to watch it just, you know, mop up the floor with categories where I would not even have the slightest chance of guessing at something.
And physically, it's just a room about the size of this studio, a large bathroom full of machines?
Yeah, basically it's what Watson is a room filled with servers, not a terribly big room, and there's a lot of air conditioning blowing because those things generate, they soak up a lot of electricity. So you go in, it's just whoosh, the sound of cold air, and that's where Watson is. When you're actually watching Watson battle, there isn't really anything of Watson in the room other than sort of a computer screen that just represents what it is. And this very funny synthesized voice. It sounds a little bit like the movie The War Games, where, you know, do you want to play a game? The computer that almost destroys...
And that ends badly.
That almost destroys the world in thermonuclear holocaust. Yeah.
And you saw the guy, the IBM scientist who's behind all this, watching these earlier practice rounds. And he was really emotionally invested in his Frankenstein.
Yeah, yeah. Dave Ferrucci, the lead scientist on this, is really one of the most intense, and I mean that in a good way, intense scientists I've ever seen. He'd been working unbelievable hours for several years, and when you watched him watching Watson, every time Watson got something wrong, his entire body would seize up. It was like watching a football coach freaking
really?
Out whenever.
I was going to say it's like Tiger Woods' father.
Yeah, no, exactly. Stabbing the air, stomping the ground. He told me that he'd actually been prescribed a mouth guard because he was grinding his teeth while watching Watson play.
And from an artificial intelligence standpoint, was there a biggest single challenge that they surmounted?
In a weird way, no. I mean, this is a funny thing. The reason why Watson can do what it does is that It doesn't look for like a single answer. Again, it tries hundreds of these different ways of statistically crunching all the data it has to try and find out, keyword combinations, all sorts of stuff to cough up the right answer. Now, scientists knew theoretically that they could do this for probably 10 years. And what changed is that IBM got these very fast computers, so they could do this stuff fast. And also the web came along and a lot of stuff got digitized. I mean, you can hoover up newspapers, you can hoover up all sorts of books, and you've got Wikipedia, which itself is a phenomenal resource of data. So in a weird way, the web came along and evolved the possibility for Watson to exist.
Is it a tremendously more advanced computer than Deep Blue was in 1997, the chess-playing computer?
Yes, in a lot of ways. Deep Blue was very advanced for its time, but it was doing really one thing, one comparatively simple thing, which is calculating the math behind chess. What's happening now with Watson is Watson looks at all the different answers that all its different ways of thinking about the problem have coughed up, and the most likely answer, the one that is coming up the most often, tends to be the one it goes with. And so you can see when an algorithm is misfired, and then you just get your team going tinkering with it and try and make it work better. And that is how it, quote-unquote, learns.
And what about 30, 40 years hence? Are you a believer in the singularity, that moment at which machines achieve truly human-like intelligence?
Not really, no. But partly because I think that what we've discovered about artificial intelligence over the 50 years we've been working at it is that the best AI tends to think and do things that are very different from the way humans think. So you get really intelligent computers, they're going to just sit in a corner and calculate, the primes to the trillionth decimal. We'll have trouble getting them to focus on anything as mundane as killing us.
So the future in your view is that we're creating a different species. And I'm not saying something that's going to take us over, but as though it's what species on other planets may be.
Exactly. To a certain extent, you can sort of almost see that in the world around us. Like the most useful sort of smart tools don't replicate what we do. They do something we can't do. And we do things they can't do. We have leaps of intuition. We have wisdom. We have the ability to forget, which turns out to be useful in making sense of the world. And when you pair those with what machines do well, as a species, we get smarter. So you could have a Watson online, that could be accessible to you or me in the same way that we use Google. And Google is just a massive supercomputer.
Where we have to do some of the thinking like
the
a computer.
Yeah, and the challenge with Watson is I'm going to not just give you a document with the answer, I'm giving you the answer.
It's getting to the computer on Star Trek, where you just ask the question and they tell you what that thing out there in space is.
Yeah.
Clive Thompson, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Clive Thompson is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine.
I don't like it, Jim. A vessel this size cannot be run by one computer.
We are attempting to prove that it can run this ship more efficiently than man.
Maybe you're trying to prove that, Spock, but don't count me in on it.
The most unfortunate lack in current computer programming is that there is nothing available to immediately replace the starship surgeon.
Very funny.
I'm not going to be one of those people battling a supercomputer on Jeopardy, but I will be on TV this week with Stephen Colbert on his Comedy Central show, The Colbert Report, on Wednesday the 16th. I'll be talking about Studio 360's new book, Spark, How Creativity Works, and also making a special announcement, and generally trying to retain some shred of dignity. If there's one author who has cornered the market on modern love, it's Elizabeth Gilbert. Her memoir, Eat, Pray, Love, was a best-selling phenomenon and became a movie starring Julia Roberts. Her follow-up memoir is called Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage. I spoke with her last year on Elizabeth Gilbert Weekend, what used to be known as Valentine's Day.
Oh my God! Is that my weekend now?
Well, I think if you're gonna claim any holiday as yours, it has to be that. Do you have a position on the official love holiday?
Oh wow! Well, you know what? It's interesting because I was doing a little research in preparation for this, and it was curious for me to discover that it wasn't until the mid-19th century that the whole practice of giving and receiving Valentines happened in America. And that's really curious because I just wrote this book about marriage, and it wasn't really until the mid-19th century that the whole practice of getting married for love came into being,
right,
or that the mass market of romance kind of happened in America. So it all seemed to happen around the same time, a time that has to do with the Industrial Revolution and the invention of the middle class and the fact that people had the luxury to be able to choose partners based on love instead of on pragmatism. So it seems like you could sort of say that romance was invented in the middle of the 19th century.
So I guess if you've accommodated yourself to marriage, you have to accommodate yourself to Valentine's Day as well, is what you're saying.
I guess so. You know, I guess because I grew up in this really pragmatic Yankee family where, you know, it was always said that it was the greeting card seller's holiday.
Yes, yes, I had the same family.
You know, it never was a huge thing in my life. I remember my dad coming home from work, and he would have stopped at the equivalent in those days of Walmart, although we didn't have it yet, and picked up some saran wrap flowers, and he would walk in and throw them on the table to my mother and say, "There." You know, which is about as romantic as
how
things
sweet.
Got. Don't say I never got you any flowers. And she would dutifully arrange them and, you know, make the best of it. But no, it's not really a holiday that's ever been very dear to my heart.
You've been a nonfiction writer, journalist for some years before you published this gigantically successful memoir. As you were thinking about your next book, which Committed is, did you ever seriously consider making it something other than the next chapter in your life story?
No, actually, to be honest, I was working on a novel when my husband got detained, arrested, and deported by the Homeland Security Department, and all of my attention was going into the novel, and then obviously this crisis in our lives and the fact that we had to spend almost a year out of the country trying to get him back in took over my attention completely at that point. And also, you know, I had realized in the writing of Eat, Pray, Love that I'm a pretty representative 21st century American woman in terms of the way that I feel fear and experience things, and I thought, I can't be the only person who has these questions and these issues to work through. So, you know, once more, let me do what I can do and other people can't do because of the nature of my work, and that is spend 3 years doing absolutely nothing but thinking about this and researching it and talking to everybody that I'm capable of talking it to, and then kind of writing up a book report that I can spread around and give to people and say, here, this is what I found out. If it's helpful, have at it.
So thanks to the difficult federal immigration authorities, they put you back on your road to your destiny, I guess.
A most unlikely Cupid was Officer Tom of the Department of Homeland Security, who arrested and handcuffed my sweetheart in front of me and took him away at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. But indeed, he was the Cupid of this marriage.
And then you married the guy, cutting to the chase. But has that guy or anybody else who was involved at that seminal moment read the book? Gotten in touch with you?
I don't know. I wonder if they'll find themselves or if somebody will bring it to their attention. I would imagine that it will seep into their consciousness somehow. It's a pretty big part of the book, that whole scene that takes place in the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. And the guy was, you know, and this is the weirdest thing that I ever find myself saying, this Homeland Security Department guy was very kind, and actually in a completely surreal twist ended up giving us marital advice when he saw our grim faces of doom after he had sentenced us to wed, and he started asking us what the problem was with it. And we explained that we'd been through divorces and we just didn't have the heart to go through it again. And he was the one who said, listen, you know, think about signing a prenuptial agreement if it's the financial stuff that worries you, or maybe you want to get some counseling. And it was just so bizarre to be sitting in the bowels of the Dallas-Fort Worth airport with this, you know, Texas Homeland Security officer with a paunch kind of wearily giving us advice on how we might do better the second time.
Good comedy scene in the movie version. How much do you think movies and television have affected the way girls and boys and women and men think about love, marriage?
Well, hugely and unquantifiably, I would imagine. You know, Shakespeare said that every tragedy ends with a death and every comedy ends with a marriage. Certainly every romantic comedy ends with a marriage. And it's such a wonderful ending point, you know, from a dramatic point of view and from a screenwriting point of view and a novelistic point of view, you could hardly wish for a better conclusion to the story. It wraps up all the tension and all the ambiguity and everything is settled. And that's wonderful and we need that. And I like those movies and I go see those movies and I enjoy those movies. But the problem is that it sets up you know, the obvious dilemma of allowing people to believe that the wedding is the end of the story.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, as anybody who's been married for more than 15 minutes knows, it doesn't really help you explain how to cope with the next five decades. There's also the problem that people will spend, you know, so very much more time having conversations with their future spouse about, you know, what color the bridesmaids' dresses are going to be and who's going to sit at what table.
Arguments over the China pattern.
Yeah, rather than having the big three conversation, you know, which are the big three issues that shipwreck
children, sex, and money.
Children, sex, and money. Oh. And if you haven't really settled that stuff, you might want to pause on the conversation about the flower arrangements.
Do you have a favorite romantic film?
Oh, so many.
Well, you can have many.
Oh, you know what it probably is? This is going to mark me as such a girl. It's probably the BBC Pride and Prejudice, that 75-hour-long one that introduced us to Colin Firth in his wet shirt, you know, coming out of the swamps near his house. That would probably be it. In fact, I recently was able to entice my husband to watch the entire thing with me. And he, you know, it's wonderful. It's Jane Austen. It's brilliant. It's witty. It's delightful. It's interesting. So he watched it. But at the end of it, when it was all over, he said, okay, tomorrow night we're watching Braveheart. And the next night, we're watching Gladiator because we have to get this out of our system. And so we went from, oh, Mr. Bennett, I certainly could not abide with that, to at the sound of my command, release hell. So it just seemed to be the only fair thing to do to permit him to go on a testosterone bender.
And of course, the Jane Austen, again and again, ends with a happy wedding and everything's nicely, tidily buttoned up.
Yeah. You know, and it wouldn't be Jane Austen if it didn't have that ending. And Julia Roberts movies and Meg Ryan movies wouldn't be themselves without that.
Now, I don't know if you've sold the movie rights to Committed yet, but you did sell the movie rights to Eat, Pray, Love. And I wondered if that gave you any pause.
You know, I certainly paused before I did it and thought about it. And, you know, I know from experience and my own experience and other people's that when, if you're lucky enough to get the opportunity to get a Hollywood movie deal for your book, the one question that you have to ask yourself is whether you are capable of walking away from it and turning it over to other people's hands and letting them do whatever they wish with it. Because any illusion that you might be offered of having any control over what it becomes is, of course, precisely an illusion. And not even directors necessarily have that much control in big Hollywood movies over the final product. And so that was the question that I had to ask myself. And actually, to be honest, I think it was easier for me to consider doing that with Eat, Pray, Love than with anything I had ever written in the
really?
Past.
Because it's you. It's the intimate details of your life.
I know. You would think it would be the opposite. But it's because of what Eat, Pray, Love became and how quickly and swiftly and dramatically it escalated to a point where it wasn't me anymore.
So you're already naked to the world. You might as well go all the way.
Yeah, it already belongs to everybody and people appropriated it already and they've claimed it, you know, for themselves in their own ways. And it really long ago grew past me feeling like it had much to do with me. And so it wasn't a big step to say, well, let it go the extra mile. You want to be a movie? Go be a movie. You're old enough to drive. Like, I didn't know you wanted to be a bestseller. So that was the feeling that I had about it.
And I suppose the idea of Julia Roberts playing one isn't so bad. How does that feel?
It feels precisely how you would think it feels. It's totally...
I don't know. I've never
totally
thought of her playing
surreal.
Me.
It's completely surreal. And I haven't even really processed that yet. And the thing that's even more surreal is the idea that my husband is going to be played by Javier Bardem and that I'm going to watch essentially me, the character of me, making out with Javier Bardem. That's the part that I really can't wrap my mind around and also can't wait to see.
Yes. Will that be for you, I wonder, pornographic or anti-pornographic or some weird combination?
I think it will be frighteningly pornographic. But, you know, actually in the end, I feel like it's going to be sort of like a home movie. And it's cool because I didn't take photographs while I was traveling. I'm not visual like that. I don't have any documentary evidence of the places that I went to that year while I was traveling. And they made a big effort with the movie to go back and refilm everything exactly where it happened. And so it's sort of like a home movie, but I've been photoshopped out and somebody so much more attractive has been photoshopped in, and that's kind of great.
You better drive back your ball.
Elizabeth Gilbert's book is called Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage, and it's now out in paperback. If a traditional Valentine's Day isn't your thing, well, you're not alone. Check out our redesign of Valentine's Day and all the associated stuff that we did last year at our beautiful new website. That's studio360.org. Coming up, a husband and wife, both writers, discover that living together isn't as productive as they'd hoped.
Finished any poems?
Not today.
What, no signal again? I make the call me gesture and wander around the sitting room saying, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion offers options that let everyone express his or her creativity to customize their car to fit their lives. Creativity begins at Scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Good relationships do take work. Not flowers and chocolate once a year. Work. And for artists who are coupled, sometimes it's even more work. If you're both writers, for instance, you might feel just a little competitive with each other. Avril Curdy is a poet. She's married to the novelist Naeem Murr. So first, the Poetry Foundation asked Naeem to write about being married to a poet. And it turned out he had a lot to get off his chest.
I've never understood poetry. You see, I'm a fiction writer. If my poet ever appears in one of my books, she shall do so as a once beautiful, but now tragically disfigured nun.
Since Naeem wrote a slightly antagonistic and satirical account of life with his poet wife, Avril Curdy, we thought, isn't it fair to get her side of the story?
For now, I will consider my novelist. For at dawn's grumbling of the L in the east, he worships in his way. For this is done by grinding the beans and making me coffee. For in these few minutes, an elegantly fragrant silence reigns.
Loving my poet as I do, I try hard to understand what a poet is. The first clue lies in the fact that my poet, every poet, is an insomniac. A friend of mine, who's a literature professor, is very enamored of my poet, whom he describes tremblingly as the real thing. The real thing. He tells me he finds it profoundly reassuring that while we ordinary mortals are asleep, there exist lit rooms containing anxious, vigilant souls. A terrible responsibility, he says, devolves upon the poet that requires her never to be fully awake or asleep. The world will end, he once told me, when the final poet awake closes her eyes. Last night, I woke up sweating, having dreamed of sinking with the rest of humanity into cold oblivion. Sure enough, my poet was fast asleep beside me, the first deep sleep she'd entered in more than a week. So I knocked a pile of books to the floor and returned to my blissful slumbers, much comforted by the thought that at least one poet would wander the midnight battlements, keep watch, and preserve us all for one more day.
My novelist's prompt and voluble good cheer in the morning strains my very last nerve. For doesn't he know we are all going to die? As he senses the magnanimous motions of his muse beginning within, my novelist burps. Now lightened in spirit, he scrawls on the door to his office, "Writer at work, no girls allowed." For he weeps for his characters, then pokes his head into my office, smiling to ask,
"You're not working, are you?" Having written 36 pages or so this morning, I take a break and seek out my poet. She's in the sitting room, leaning her forehead hopelessly against the window pane, staring into the street. "Finished any poems?"
"Not today."
"What, no signal again?" I make the call me gesture and wander around the sitting room saying, "Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?" She tells me quietly that if I don't leave her alone, she's going to disembowel me with her pencil. I lay low for a bit and then very quietly carry my chair into the sitting room. She's still staring out of the window, unmoved, I get up onto the chair with my manuscript, which I lift as high as I can before dropping. Oh, I didn't mean to disturb you, I say. Just wanted to get a sense of the heft of this new novel. It's a whopper.
Always he asks of each of my poems, but what does it mean? For a poem should not mean but be, I intone. For he says, yes, be pretty. No, for I like poems oblique as the reverse of antique tapestries and hard enough to crack a tooth on. For my novelist adds that he prefers poems with a good clear moral, or a beautiful but disfigured nun, and a bit of the old boom-chaka-boom-chaka-boom-boom-boom. Still gyrating his hips and giggling, he makes oatmeal for breakfast. For he writes only 50 pages before breakfast, and so worries he's suffering writer's block, which he's pretty sure he caught from a toilet seat.
My poet actually did start to get the signal this morning and spent almost 6 hours scribbling in her notebook. The result? 10 lines on a single page. That page is now impaled upon her corkboard, trapped in a terrible limbo with her other poems in progress, some of them years old and countless drafts thick. I find her reading in her office and ask what her new poem is about.
That starling we saw. The one trapped in the Amtrak station.
And?
And that's what it's about.
So a tale of triumph. Little guy against the corporate machine.
No. Via negativa. Apophasis. I'm thinking of what it's not.
What is not?
What the starling is not.
She points at her corkboard.
Why don't you just read it?
I do. And for a moment I feel as if the top of my head has come off. Immediately followed by the rather unpleasant sensation that someone's rattling a stick around in there. Whoa, I say. Deep. I pretend to stagger for a while under the weight of its profundity. Feeling I've done my duty, I ask if I can tell her the plot of my new novel.
If you must,
she says, with that expression of desperate eagerness very particular to her, and strangely reminiscent of most people's expressions when they're not very eager at all. A woman has 2 children, a boy and a girl. I start to cry, but hold off. And she dies from the cancer.
What kind of cancer?
Cancer of the left ventricle. The key to good fiction is being specific. And they all keen and grieve, and her son becomes a boxer because he's full of anger at God, and her daughter becomes a nun, chaste, but under her cassock...
Habit.
What?
Nuns wear habits.
Why are you saying things I can't understand? Anyway, her loveliness is wasted because her cassock catches fire and she becomes horribly disfigured.
Stop!
She shouts. Mildly disfigured?
Just stop, please.
A small scar that's actually quite becoming?
This is exactly the same as your other novel.
I can see she's in pain. My plots always move her. I don't get why poems can't have such stirring plots. Her poem is about what a starling is not. It seems to me that in a way all poems are about what a starling is not. Where's the passion? The triumph, human will overcoming tragedy and breaching the indifferent? Where disfigured nuns cast off their cassocks to bear their beauty? Where boxers beat men to a bloody pulp and cry up to heaven, here, here, damn you, is the work of my hands! A starling, I say.
A starling? Why don't I just pop them out, he wonders. For he writes the story, and I write the song of the story. Plot bores me. He can have it. For who wants to worry always about this and then that and then this, when we are all going to die?
I don't know if this is one of the reasons my professor friend calls her the real thing, but my poet loves words in a way that I feel is quite unhealthy and unnatural. She owns a dictionary decades old, and so large she uses a small buffet cart to wheel it around our apartment like some invalid relative. The secret to a poet's soul lies somewhere in the little cells of that dungeonish dictionary, in the slow languishing of those old, mad, forgotten words. It's also in the very particular kind of art she, and every poet, seems to love. Joseph Cornell. I guarantee you will not find a single poet who doesn't start rubbing herself against the furniture the minute you mention Cornell and his little boxes full of human residue, the pleasures of the miniature. One good thing, though, is that after we went to see the Cornell exhibit some years ago, I got the idea to give her, for her birthday, a tobacco box in which I glued lots of small objects. Secret decoder rings, vintage bottle caps, my grandfather's glass eye. She gushed. Like a Cornell, I pointed out.
I love it because you made it.
It's just like a Cornell.
You usually just give me cash.
Isn't it exactly like a Cornell?
I love it. Thank you.
Since then, that's what I've given her for every present. Small things glued into boxes, shoe boxes, cereal boxes, bento boxes, Happy Meal boxes. She does seem a little less enthusiastic.
For he is my dream of an old house. In my dream, I have lived in this house for years. When I open a door I've never seen before and enter a room filled with comforts and curiosities, a fox's spine strung within a bell jar, a doll's head crowned by a hive of honeybees. For this is how it feels when I read my novelist's new book. For then my next poem, trembling now like the meniscus upon a glut cup, now full as a melting icicle's bleb showing the inverted world, my next poem will be an elegy infused with beauty and sorrow and the awareness that we are all going to die. For just write it, he says, spill it out, as though a poem is ever just written. Why don't I just write it? Well, I'll tell you. Because I am the cavalry charge into the cannon's maw, the winning run thrown out at home, the heroic yet impotent gesture.
My poet is in the sitting room with her forehead pressed to the window again. It's actually been a good week for us. I sold my new novel after a bidding war for $11 million. And my poet had a poem taken by a well-known literary journal, which gave payment in the form of an origami swan made out of her recycled submission. But I've been feeling contrite. I forgot our anniversary in January. Quietly, I approach my poet, who is lost in thought. In truth, health, riches, and a vast readership are as nothing compared to this moment. My poet turning to me, her face dilating beautifully as she murmurs like an approaching revelation. Glaucus. But her face soon clouds. Whatever it was didn't take hold, and the abortive flush of it leaves her sad and drawn. This seems a good time to hand her my anniversary gift. I'm sorry it's late. As she unwraps it, I walk away.
What's this?
She calls after me. A Cornell, I say.
Did you make it?
Oh no, that, I say, pointing back at her, at my genuine and indisputable poet. That is the real thing.
For it is Valentine's Day, and this morning a new poem, more visionary than Dante's Inferno, more definitive than the wasteland, seeps into every cell of my body when my novelist knocks on the door. For with a rose in his mouth, undressed only in a ribbon, he asks,
"You weren't planning to work today, were you?"
Naeem Murr and Averil Curti. You can find out where to read their books at our brand spanking new website, studio360.org. Did I mention it just launched and is approximately 1 million times cooler than our old website? That's studio360.org. And if you're in or near New York City this week, please come out and join me next Tuesday at the Barnes & Noble in Tribeca. We're celebrating the publication of Studio 360's new book. It's called Spark, How Creativity Works, and it is full of insights and stories from some of America's most creative people.
Talking to my dog before I sit down in the morning to work on my poems, and I say to him in a kind of manic glee, "Poetry Man is shooting up."
There's more just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. This year, Studio 360 is celebrating its 10th year on the air, and we've got a new book coming out called Spark, How Creativity Works, which is full of great stories and tips from some of the hundreds of writers and filmmakers and musicians and artists we've featured on the show. Last week, we put you all to the test. We wanted to know if you had made something fantastic out of unexpected materials. People sent their photographs to studio360.org, and we got some amazing submissions.
My name is Stefan Dresbach-Williams, and I live in Spokane, Washington. I'm the director of education for Spokane Civic Theater and sort of perpetually obsessed with the relationship between performer and audience.
Stefan decided to bring theater to a temporarily captive audience, people stuck in their cars during rush hour in Spokane.
We took Hamlet and condensed each act into a 7 to 10 word sentence. We wrote those words on a piece of cardboard and held these signs next to a major off-ramp here in Spokane off I-90 and did one act each day over a 5-day work week and in hopes of creating theater and recontextualizing performance as kind of begging.
And did the drivers going by have any idea what was going on?
The first couple days, there was a lot of confusion. We had a cop stop by on Act 3 to just make sure we weren't obstructing traffic. But they came to start looking for us and seemed to appreciate us. We got a lot of thumbs up, occasional dollars that were offered to us.
And on the other side of the country, in Newton, Mass., outside Boston, Mark Chasen saw the 4-foot-long icicles hanging off his roof and decided to make an ice sculpture.
I broke a couple off and stuck them in the snow upside down and made a kind of little ice forest.
And how many icicles did you harvest?
Harvest? That's a good way to put it. Probably something like 30.
Really?
Two of my kids were helping out, and I think the neighborhood thought I was crazy.
Yeah.
You know, people were driving by and stopping and talking to us. It was a pretty neat thing.
That's great. It's interesting. It's the kind of thing that one's kids would do and you'd worry about them stabbing themselves or something, but then here's dad out there doing it with them. I guess it's okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I guess it's the kid in me.
And in Berea, Kentucky, Esther Randall found her inspiration at the breakfast table.
Well, I was drinking coffee and noticed the grounds on the bottom of my cup reminded me of Asian paintings. So I started photographing them and then layering them and altering the size and density of the photo and created these imaginary landscapes.
The image Esther sent to us looks like giant, rugged, snow-covered mountains.
They look as though they have watercolor washes. The colors are very soft and muted. But the mountains, if you think of them as mountains, they're at once rather cold-looking, but I think the forms are quite beautiful. I live, you know, like in Kentucky with the hills, and so the hills in these works resonate with my drive home.
I want to thank everybody who has so far submitted their ideas to Studio 360. You can see the pictures of every listener creation at studio360.org. And we want more. We want to know what you've created out of whatever improbable materials. Go to studio360.org and show us. We're going to send copies of our new book, Spark, How Creativity Works, to the person with the most creative concoction. The deadline is Sunday night at midnight, so go to studio360.org right now. And speaking of Spark, How Creativity Works, our longtime executive producer, Julie Burstein, who put the book together, is in the studio with me right now to talk a little more about it. Welcome back, Julie.
Thank you, Kurt. This week I have something a little more difficult for us to look at, but I think very rewarding, and that is to talk about artists who stand in what the educator Parker Palmer calls the tragic gap. He doesn't mean tragic sad. He means tragic inevitable. And what he talks about is people who can hold the tension between the world as it is and what we hope it might be. And so these are artists who can look squarely at heartbreak and at war and at death.
I think the point that you just made about looking squarely at things is so important and so applicable to everybody's life in dealing with difficulty, in dealing with life.
Yes, and that's sometimes the hardest thing to do. And that's why I thought these three artists were really people we should hear from again.
Who's the first?
We have Lynn Nottage first. She is the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. She wrote Ruined in 2009.
Great play.
Really wonderful play about a really tough subject, which is women in the Democratic Republic of Congo who had been brutalized in their civil war. And she didn't want to just look at the awful side of this.
I wanted to look at the human side. I was really interested in what happens to the human spirit and how does love continue to flourish in the face of such ugliness and brutality.
That was a terrific play, Ruined. And one of the things about it, it avoided what this kind of art often risks doing, which is turning into a polemic and with everything black and white. This is a very emotionally complicated play. She doesn't sort of sugarcoat anything, but there's also humor, there's compassion, there's all the range of human emotion.
There's life in this play, and she was very careful, she said, to make sure that it wasn't a polemic. Though she did do her research. She went to Uganda and she interviewed women who had fled the Congo. And she said she found to her surprise that they were eager to talk to her because they said no one had ever asked them to tell their stories from beginning to end, because some of these stories are very, very disturbing. From these interviews, Nottage created her characters, such as this one that we're going to hear now, Salima, who describes working in her garden one morning, her baby playing right near her.
The sun was about to crest, but I had to put in another hour before it got too hot. It was such a clear and open sky. Oh, this splendid bird, a peacock, had come into the garden to taunt me and was showing off its feathers. I stooped down and called to the bird, "Hst, hst," and I felt a shadow cut across my back. And when I stood, four men were there over me, smiling wicked schoolboy smiles. "Yes," I said. And the tall soldier slammed the butt of his gun into my cheek. Just like that. It was so quick, I didn't even know I'd fallen to the ground. Where did they come from? How could I not have heard them?
One of the things that I encountered when I was interviewing women is a lot of them spoke of not anticipating the moment, is that suddenly the men were upon them and they were either in a field or they were in their homes and someone kicked in the door and then they were there, so that their daily life was suddenly interrupted. And one of the things also in that moment I was conjuring, I was just thinking of 9/11 on that day, which was just such a clear, beautiful, absolutely perfect, pristine day, and how suddenly our lives can be changed so absolutely in a moment.
That's something, when I heard her talk about that, I could relate to so powerfully, that idea of something changing in a moment, in part because of our experience right here at Studio 360 during the attack on the World Trade Center, which was just down the street from our offices. And on 9/11, we looked to art too. Remember that show we did a few weeks afterwards where we just needed to look to art for solace.
Exactly.
And then a few months after that, you spoke to the amazing photographer Joel Meyerowitz, who had documented what had happened there.
And what's so interesting about Joel, whose work I've loved forever and who I've known a little bit as well, is so much of his previous work were photographs of these beautiful Cape Cod sunsets and things like that. And he told me the story of how he decided right after 9/11, partly because he lived near the Ground Zero site, that he had to make an archive of this destruction and went down to the site while it was still smoking and smoldering and being cleared just a couple of days after the attack.
And like all the other passerby, I stood outside the chain link fence on Chambers in Greenwich, and all I could see was the smoke and a little bit of rubble. And I raised my camera to take a peek just to see if there was something to see. And some cop, a lady cop, hit me on my shoulder and said, "Hey, no pictures." And it was such a blow that it woke me up in the way that it was meant to be, I guess. And when I asked her why no pictures, she said, it's a crime scene. No photographs allowed. And I asked her what would happen if I was a member of the press. And she told me, "Oh, look back there." And back a block was the press corps tied up in a little penned-in area. And I said, "Well, when do they go in?" And she said, "Probably never." And as I walked away from that, I had this crystallization, probably from the blow, because it was an insult in a way. I thought, oh, if there's no pictures, then there'll be no record. And so we need a record. And I thought, I'm going to make that record. I'll find a way to get in because I don't want to see this history disappear.
And his pictures are extraordinary and moving and powerful, but they're also beautiful because he can't help but make beautiful images in a certain way. So I asked him if that felt uncomfortable to make such gorgeous pictures of such horror and devastation.
Well, you know, ugly, I mean, powerful and tragic and horrific and everything, but it was also, as in nature, an enormous event that was transformed after the fact into this residue. And like many other ruins, you go to the ruins of the Colosseum or the ruins of a cathedral someplace, and they take on a new meaning when you watch the weather. I mean, there were afternoons I was down there, and the light goes pink, and there's a mist in the air, and you're standing in the rubble. And I found myself recognizing both the inherent beauty of nature and the fact that nature as time is erasing this wound. Time is unstoppable, and it transforms the event. It gets further and further away from the day, and light and seasons temper it in some way. And it's not that I'm a romantic. It's that the reality, I mean, I'm really a realist. The reality is there's the Woolworth Building, you know, in a veil of smoke from the site, but it's now like a scrim across a theater, and it's turning pink, you know, and down below there are hoses spraying, and the lights have come on for the evening, and the water is turning acid green because the sodium lamps are on. And I'm thinking, my God, who could dream this up? But the fact is, I'm there. It looks like that. You have to take a picture.
Also, I think, again, it's a key to creativity. His idea, I'm going to go down there every day for a year, and he did. I mean, people think of artists having great inspirations and then creating their masterpieces. He realized, because he's been in this doing this work for 50 years, that it's a matter of going and doing the work every day, even in this horrific environment.
And I'm so grateful that he did, because now, almost 10 years later, you go to that site and it's entirely changed. And so what we have left is his pictures of it.
Exactly.
To end, I wanted to bring in an artist who doesn't look at a world trauma. What he does is he looks at a personal trauma. This is the poet Donald Hall, who was here a year after 9/11 for our show on memorials. And he talks about how, after the death of his wife, the poet Jane Kenyon, work on the poems that became his book Without was really what sustained him.
In Without, at one point, I'm talking to my dog before I sit down in the morning to work on my poems, and I say to him in a kind of manic glee, "Poetry Man is shooting up." And that's how I felt. And for that first year after Janie died, I could work on the poems of Without for a couple of hours, perhaps. And then I had 22 miserable hours to wait until I could get back to them again, because I can't work on poetry all day. But the 2 hours were the only hours of happiness at that time.
And when you hear Hall, you hear the life in him and the humor. And one of the things about the poems in this book, some of them are just heartbreaking, but others are really funny. And he talked about how people got a little upset about that, but he said he would put jokes in that his wife would have loved, that she would have roared with laughter about. And that was really important to him. He travels around the country reading his poems, and he often reads these poems, some of the most devastating poems. And Donald Hall said, inevitably, someone will come up to him after the reading and say, "How can you read that?" And he said, "It's not a problem."
They start out as screams of pain, and as I work on them, they will come to be something outside me. It is as if I were working with hacking away at a piece of stone to make sculpture, or modeling, or trying to paint, adding a little dash of this and that, so that they become works of art. They become a work of art in the art that I love, that I've tried to practice since I was 12 years old. Then they are objectified. They're out there. They start from the pain.
They start from the anguish, these poems do, and then they become something that means to be in itself as language, as sound, as imagery, objects of pleasure, objects that give pleasure.
I've never heard a more succinct and perfect summary of what art at its best can do. And he went on to talk about this is one of the paradoxes of poetry, of all poetry for thousands of years, as well as art, that the subject, because we all deal with it, is death so often and defeat and loss. But there's not one way to react to those things.
Absolutely. And all of these artists are doing that. They're reflecting on these terrible things that happen to us and taking us someplace else.
So I'll let you come back next week if we talk about something happier.
Absolutely. And I think these are not unhappy things. These are really powerful. And I think in my own life of the way that work and art have helped me through some of the most difficult things I've ever had to encounter.
Julie Burstein, thanks.
My pleasure.
Julie is the author of Studio 360's new book, Spark, How Creativity Works, which comes out next week. You can find out more about it and how to get a copy of Spark at our website, studio360.org, our wonderful new website that is so truly new and improved, I almost can't believe it. Go there now. And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening.
Happy Valentine's Day. Hey.
Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Michael Guerriero,
Julia Botero,
Sarah Dalia,
Mary Du.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the comedian Patton Oswalt explains teenagers once and for all.
For me and my circle of high school friends, it came down to zombies, spaceships, or wastelands.
It turns out spaceships could make pretty good parents.
They treat their houses like spaceships that have landed on Earth and their spouses and kids like crew members.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.